I'd just been handed the portfolio. Gladys Berejiklian asked me to be her Minister for Energy and Environment. Pretty quickly after that, I went overseas, Germany, and saw what was happening in Europe and how far ahead of the curve they were. And the penny dropped pretty quickly that this wasn't just a moral argument and an environmental argument. It was an economic imperative for us to take action on climate change.
We live in the 21st century. And Germany was, until recently, one of the top five leading industrial economies. And now we are forced to have a serious conversation. If it's a cold winter, will the German people freeze to death? That's a medieval conversation. These are conversations you probably had 500 years ago.
We know that there's an economic arms race underway for the next generation of jobs, investments, export opportunities, and economic prosperity.
Obviously, Matt Keane has had well-publicised views on renewable energy.
Matt's doing terrific stuff on renewables in New South Wales, and we support it.
Matt Keane is the most despised politician in the history of state politics.
Thanks, Mark Latham, for that timeless quote. Hello, my name is Ben Beattie, and welcome to the Baseload Podcast. Remember, if you have comments, feedback, or corrections, the mailbag is always open. You can reach me by typing one word, thebaseloadpodcast@gmail.com. Our opening segment there was Matt Keane in his own words a couple of years ago on the Guardian Australia podcast, telling Catherine Murphy how his energy policy is inspired by Germany. Both Murphy and Keane now work for Anthony Albanese, some say a natural fit. I added in a few words from Ralph Schellhammer describing the current situation in Germany, plus some comments from Matt Canavan, Adam Bandt, and the always frank Mark Latham. The Daily Telegraph's Bush Summit was held in Orange, New South Wales, on 29th of August 2024. Amongst the speaking events, former New South Wales Liberal MP, now Albanese-appointed bureaucrat, Matt Keane, debated Barnaby Joyce about the pros and cons of nuclear. This episode, instead of the GOAT, I thought I'd slice and dice the audio and give them both a monologue of talking points that makes their position clear. That way, we can identify the message through the shouting. In other news, AEMO has released its annual electricity statement of opportunities, and the usual suspects perform their fawning over reporting on the forced renewables rollout. As you might expect, I'll take a different view. The new head of the Poles and Wires lobby appeared on Renewal Comedy with a predictable outcome. Finally, we catch Jonathan Fisher, CEO of Cauldron Energy, for his view of the world. Before we get into the Keane-Joyce debate, let's recap some of Keane's statements on energy from the last couple of years. Matt Keane's delivery is well rehearsed. He's been defending his anti-nuclear and pro-renewable stance for years now. Back in 2022, he appeared on the ABC's flagship conservative baiting panel show Q&A, along with journalist Greg Sheridan. Here's a flavour of that confrontation.
Our failing to go from 35% in 2030 to 45%. Means 10% of our emissions, which is 0.1 of 1%.
Greg, people like you are just apologists for our environmental destruction. People like you are standing in the way of grabbing these enormous economic opportunities. You're on the wrong side of history here, Greg, and people like you should get out of the way and allow us to do it.
Matt Keane's not above catastrophising about the effects of climate change.
Australia should be leading the way when it comes to taking action on climate change, because the cost of us not doing so is going to be enormous. Just ask the farmers in New South Wales who had to have their water shipped in, trucked in, because of the worst drought in living memory. Just ask the family that lost their house in the Black Summer bushfires on the south coast. Just ask the tourist operator on the Great Barrier Reef.
Keane's catastrophising echoes another well-known anti-nuclear and pro-renewables voice.
Paris Agreement is about keeping global warming to less than 2 degrees, well less than 2 degrees, preferably 1.5. And if we don't manage to do that, we may as well say goodbye to the reef. The unprecedented fire events that we've had recently will become every other year, and large parts of Australia will become both uninsurable and unlivable.
The Boy Who Cried Wolf is a story with a message. If you tell lies, people will not believe you when you tell the truth. My position on climate change is this: it's going to happen anyway. Whatever the effects of a changing climate, nothing we do here in Australia has any effect. This is an elemental truth that must be acknowledged. Ignoring this fact undermines the position of anybody claiming to care about climate change. Unending catastrophizing wears thin. It's the boy who cried wolf on a global scale. The risk of not acknowledging the truth, that making us poorer hurts us far more than climate change ever can, means that sensible policies are at best deprioritized and at worst eliminated. all in the race to have the best bragging rights at overseas conferences. It is debatable whether stopping every kilogram of CO2 emissions in the world today would have any effect on climate change. It is debatable whether an atmosphere already saturated with greenhouse gases can warm any further. It is debatable whether extreme weather events are caused by a warmer atmosphere. What is not debatable is that silly alarmist warnings never come true. It is not debatable that emissions reduction policies increase the cost of living. It is not debatable that emissions reduction and renewable energy targets are entirely arbitrary and that promises of cheaper electricity always fail to materialise. Here's some promises made by Matt Keane, spread across a couple of ABC episodes.
Our energy infrastructure plan will drive down household bills by on average $130 per household and by on average $430 for businesses across this state. So it's going to reduce our emissions, but also drive down household bills and grow our economy.
I think this could be one of the biggest economic opportunities of that our country will ever see.
The thing is that in a low-carbon global economy, there's nowhere better place to take advantage of these opportunities than Australia.
Investing in the opportunities of the future to make sure we set ourselves up to grab those enormous economic opportunities that are going to come with a low-carbon future. I mean, a transition to a low-carbon future means jobs in Australia, investment coming into this country, and prosperity like we've never seen before. So,
and we can produce that hydrogen, ship it to Japan and South Korea.
We can be literally the Saudi Arabia of sun.
Those renewable energy resources can be used to create support heavy industry in creating things like green aluminium, green steel, and also provide the world's energy needs in a low carbon future, like producing green hydrogen, which we're really well placed to do.
No country on the planet is better placed to benefit from the transition to a low-carbon future than Australia.
We've got some of the best renewable resources anywhere on the planet.
You need very, very low-cost electricity. The only way you can get that is through renewables.
If you're finding it difficult to tell which clip is from which episode of which show, you're not alone. Matt Keane is so well-rehearsed and says the same things over and over again, pretty much in the same tone of voice and the same cadence, I might add, that the only way I can tell is from the audio software I'm using has different colours for different clips, so I can see the colour change visually, but just by going by my ears, he could be on the same show saying all that stuff. Some might say that a politician sticking to the script so well is evidence of a lack of authenticity, but I don't think so. I think Matt Keane is entirely authentic because he's a teal bordering on a green.
Matt's doing terrific stuff on renewables in New South Wales, and we support it.
I'd go as far as to say that Matt Keane's endorsement of renewables is much more polished than Adam Bandt's, even though they say the same thing.
We are blessed in Australia now with all of the sun and the wind and the technology that we need. We have the technology right now to make the transition.
Apart from being in complete lockstep with the Greens and other energy policy extremists, Keane has a predictable position on nuclear.
Let's go to our next question, and it comes from Tyrone Delisle.
My question is for Adam Bandt. I'm the spokesperson for Greens for Nuclear Energy Australia, a group of Greens members and supporters calling on the party to change its position on nuclear energy. The IPCC and the European Union Joint Research Centre, among other peak scientific bodies, have found that nuclear energy is as safe as solar and wind and has equal or lower life cycle emissions. Why then do the Greens continue to reject nuclear energy? Is it about transitioning the right way, as one European Greens MP suggested, rather than transitioning rapidly?
Adam Bandt?
Thanks, Tyrone. I mean, we've got... Firstly, it's too expensive. It'll be too long to get in action in Australia in the time that we need, and it's not safe.
People chasing nuclear are chasing a unicorn. The reality is that those people pushing this nuclear campaign are just trying to find an excuse to prolong the use of coal in our system.
Like, it's if you have an accident at a wind farm, it's a stiff freeze. If you have an accident at a nuclear power plant, it's Chernobyl.
Well, I mean, these people pursuing nuclear is like pursuing a fantasy. The reality is it doesn't stack up at the moment on practical grounds or on economic grounds. Nuclear energy is about 2 to 3 times more expensive than coal, and which is multiple times more expensive than renewables backed up by storage.
We know that the cheapest way to deliver electricity today is now a combination of wind, solar, battery and pumped hydro.
All right, enough of Matt Keane for this segment. I will leave the last word on Matt Keane's, what do they call them, progressive energy policies to the leader of one of the most extreme political groups in the country, Adam Bandt.
Matt's doing terrific stuff on renewables in New South Wales, and we support it.
AEMO's Electricity Statement of Opportunities was released in August, and the Integrated System Plan in July. For those wondering exactly what these reports are for, AEMO has its very own podcast to explain it all. First, though, let's hear the biggest lie about renewables directly from the head of AEMO, Daniel Westerman.
Renewable energy connected in with transmission and distribution, firmed up with storage and backed up with gas, is the lowest cost way to supply electricity reliably to Australian homes and businesses throughout that transition to a net zero economy.
Now, this is absolute rubbish and pure propaganda from AEMO. The Integrated System Plan, which he's referring to, does not chart the least cost system. Pretty much everybody acknowledges that by now, except for some reason the bloody journalists and the media, who should be onto this, because every time somebody in one of these bureaucracies claims that the Integrated System Plan is the cheapest path, it is very, very simple and easy to show it is not. Whether you start at the CSIRO, tipping the scales on the cost of building and operating power stations, whether it's the transmission cost blowouts that seem to hit the news every week, and we'll talk about one of those in a minute, or is it the excluded costs like Snowy 2, Barumba, and all those coordinated home batteries, 150 gigawatts of it, the extra gas power stations that exclude all the gas pipelines required? What about any distribution network upgrades? And finally, maybe the easiest way to, you know, prove that this is not cheap, this plan, is to go to the generation and storage outlook spreadsheets, which, by the way, is where Mr. Bowen gets his $122 billion figure from, and just look at the extra $370 billion in spending on generation alone that's flagged in that. That's not cheap, and it's not cheap because there's a lot of stuff. I wrote this on LinkedIn. The 2024 ISP basic scenario wants to increase rooftop solar, wind, and large-scale solar from 46 gigawatts today to 90 gigawatts by 2030. That's double, and far exceeds the existing coal capacity of 21 gigawatts. By 2040, they want that up to 157 gigawatts, including offshore wind, and by 2050, they want 212 gigawatts. AEMO's annual install rates up until 2030 are, for 2025-26, 4,499 megawatts, the next year, 10,510 megawatts, the next year, 7,263 megawatts, very specific, the next year, 9,051 megawatts, and in 2029-30, 13,604 megawatts. It's laughable. This is the information all the other groups depend on, from Chris Bowen to Matt Keane to Productivity Commission to every lobby group to every state planning report to all the eight-letter bureaucracies. It's all bogus. They all refer to AEMO's Integrated System Plan as if it's actually going to happen, as if it's a forecast. Nobody should refer to the ISP as anything more than a shopping list. That got a few comments. No one's really arguing the point. I mean, it's hard to argue against the facts that AEMO put out there. This is what AEMO are saying. They're not trying to hide it. All that's happening is that nobody's talking about it. Matt Keane's Climate Change Authority has completely misunderstood and misinterpreted the ISP. Keane believes the ISP is a forecast, but it's not. It's scenarios. Here's a quote from the Climate Change Authority's, Matt Keane's new gig, from their latest report. The Australian Energy Market Operator has forecast for the optimal development path in its step change scenario a quadrupling of firming capacity from sources alternative to coal that can respond to the changing output from variable renewable generation. Much of the forecast growth is in residential batteries forming virtual power plants, which becomes increasingly important alongside utility-scale batteries and pumped hydro. The Australian Energy Council's submission stated that long-duration storage requires policy support to provide certainty to investment decisions that factor in long build times, high capital expenditure, and prospects of delay. So this is Matt Keane's Climate Change Authority, and they continue. on battery energy storage systems. AEMO's 2024 Integrated Systems Plan projects significant growth in residential batteries. This is incorrect. AEMO, in the Integrated System Plan, does not make projections, it makes targets. It sets a target based on the government policy and it says that's what we need. It's not a forecast. It's not a prediction of what's going to happen in the future. It's a demand. They're saying we need this to happen, not we expect this to happen. Keane was interviewed by the ABC's Patricia Karvelas. And this is what Keane said about what he's expecting to get out of the Climate Change Authority. What advice that august esteemed establishment is going to provide our federal government.
The experts say that if we get this transition right, we can put downward pressure on energy bills for Australians and businesses across the country. We can protect our environment and make the economy more prosperous for everyone. And what that transition looks like, based on the evidence, the modelling, both scientific and economic, from the CSIRO, is firmed renewables rolled out quickly at scale right now.
But that's not what any of the CSIRO or anybody else says, for that matter. Even the CSIRO's GenCost report is focusing on investment beyond 2030. It's got nothing to do with investment today. If it was all working so well, why would we need to extend the subsidy program into, as the renewable energy target ramps down, finally, it's going to be replaced with the capacity investment scheme. And what is that meant to do? It's meant to overcome the oversupply problems that we must have with these plans and these scenarios and these targets. You can't have 82% renewables as a megawatt hour number across a year without overbuilding massively. And overbuilding massively means there's going to be periods where there's too much. There's going to be oversupply, which means that those generators won't have as many megawatt hours to earn their dollars back. Therefore, the capacity investment scheme is going to guarantee them income regardless of what their megawatt hours are. They guarantee revenue. And in Matt Keane's opinion, why are we doing all this?
This is a global effort to get to net zero, not just an Australian effort. We'll do our bit and we want to make sure we're doing our bit in the context of the geopolitical environment.
A global effort to reduce emissions, hey? Righto. Let's do a bit of good old cherry picking.
Sweden, yes, the land that gave us the child climate activist Greta Thunberg, has just announced it's scrapping its green energy targets because the finance minister who announced the scheme said Sweden needs a stable energy system. The minister, Elisabeth Svantesson, said that wind and solar are too unstable to meet the nation's energy requirements, saying this creates the conditions for nuclear power.
Air New Zealand is abandoning its 2030 goal to cut its carbon emissions. In a statement, Air New Zealand said, quote, many of the levers needed to meet the target, including the availability of new aircraft, the affordability and availability of alternative jet fuel, and global and domestic regulatory and policy support are outside of the airline's direct control and remain challenging.
On the 23rd of July, 2021, President Michael D. Higgins passed the Climate Action Act into Irish law. The act means Ireland is on a legally binding path to net zero emissions no later than 2050, with an interim 51% target by 2030. That day, Minister Eamon Ryan said that although the 2030 target was ambitious, it gave us an opportunity to transform our economy, create new jobs, and build a greener and fairer future. But 3 years on, current projections suggest we will fall well short of our targets by the end of the decade.
To be sure, Australia will also fall well short of its targets, currently 43%, but the Teals are after a 75% reduction. Who else said something about a 75% emissions reduction? I wonder if I can dig up a clip of, say, Adam Bandt saying exactly the same thing at least a couple of years ago now.
75% emissions cuts by 2030, because that is what we need to meet that 1.5 degree goal.
And that sounds not dissimilar to this.
The Integrated System Plan is essentially a roadmap for Australia's energy transition and energy system for the next 20 plus years out to a net zero energy system by 2050.
Okay, so it does bug me a little bit that I have to keep harping on about the ISP, because to be honest, it's transmission planning. That's what it does. This is what it's meant to do. Kick off transmission. It's not a plan. It's not integrated, and it doesn't cover the whole system. All it's meant to do is initiate transmission projects, and that's what it does. What does our old friend Mr. Keane have to say about transmission? Central Arana RES, renewable energy zones. How good are they, do you think, according to Matt Keane?
For example, our renewable energy zones. That's basically the modernisation of our electricity system. And that will see about $32 billion worth of private capital going into rural and regional Australia. That means jobs, that means opportunities, and an investment boom like the regions have never seen before in this state.
Okay, in this day and age, anyone who's been on the internet recently has seen the memes, which is, this is how it started, this is how it's going, and that was how it started. And this is how it's going.
We begin tonight with a cost blowout you may struggle to comprehend. We've all been told that renewable energy is the future, but 7News has been given the new numbers that expose the true cost of the Central West Renewable Energy Zone. Originally slated at $650 million, tonight we can tell you that figure has blown out to more than $5 billion. And the bill is coming to you.
Oh, no. Oh, no! No, no! No, no!
That's a clip from one of the Planet of the Apes movies where you got some chimpanzee very concerned about something not going quite right there. It's all over the internet at the moment. I thought I'd chuck it in. I'll use it sparingly, I promise. $5 billion would get you a couple of brand new coal-fired power stations in a critical part of the network. No worries at all. The Central West Arana Renewable Energy Zone is situated around Dubbo in New South Wales. The ISP says it'll be around about 6,000 megawatts of capacity. And this is the problem with this whole central planning arrangement of transmission lines and, you know, so-called least cost options for generators, is that it's got to be built no matter what. Even if the costs do blow out, a state government may well just say, no thanks, we'll bail out, because their jobs will be on the line with the voters. But because the decisions and the planning has been given to the bureaucracies, such as AEMO, etc., the politicians, the energy ministers, have abrogated their responsibility. They're not accountable for this. It's not their fault. Something that I would do if I had the power, if I was king for a day, would be remove AEMO's central planning authority to initiate transmission projects and give that accountability and responsibility back to the states. I would put AEMO back in their box where they're supposed to be, balancing the frequency and settling the dollars of the daily operations of the marketplace. What's worse, and compounding the errors, is that all the people involved in this stuff and the way they speak about it, they say it's as if the whole renewables transition is a foregone conclusion. I think that's incredibly dangerous. Have a listen to this from the AEMO Statement of Opportunities podcast.
The next 10 years, we're embarking on a significant transition of the energy system. And there is continued opportunity for new investments to come into the market to maintain the reliability of the power system.
So this Electricity Statement of Opportunities report is all about reliability. It's not about cost or operability. It's more just making sure that there's no supply gaps. Now, if everything's going so well with the renewables transition, why how would there be any supply gaps? Let's listen.
The ESO identifies reliability gaps. We then trigger actions to ensure that those gaps are closed in operational timeframes.
What? Gaps? No way. Not with such a affirmed low-cost wind and solar solution that we're all going to be given. How can we possibly get gaps? Oh, and also, what do they mean by gaps? I guess they mean blackouts, right?
With expected investments of generation, storage and transmission, if those projects are delivered on time and in full, then, and with the coordination of consumer energy resources, then we would expect that the reliability experience that us consumers will have, that we will all have, will be within the relevant reliability standards over most of the next decade.
It's a reliability experience. I mean, what could be better when you're sitting there trying to watch Neighbours, actually, Neighbours are streamed now. But, oh, yeah, you'd need to... you need electricity to watch the TV, no matter what show it is. So, yes, I'll take Neighbours. You're sitting there trying to watch your Neighbours, and the power goes out. Is that a reliability experience that we're talking about here? And what's this? There's a lot of dependency on the word expected. When I look through the ESOO report itself, I find 217 instances of the word expected. And here's one. In a sentence that starts like this, in a section called disclaimer. There will usually be differences between estimated and actual results, because events and circumstances frequently do not occur as expected, and those differences may be material. I find that really interesting, because just above the disclaimer, under the words important notice and purpose, reads this sentence. The purpose of this publication is to provide technical and market data that informs the decision-making processes of market participants, new investors, and jurisdictional bodies as they assess opportunities in the national electricity market over a 10-year outlook period. Please, Amo, tell me a little bit more about expected.
This ESOO in particular, it really highlights that there is a significant amount of expected investments in generation, storage, and transmission, and these really need to be delivered on time and in full to really maintain the reliability of the grid to supply homes and businesses with the electricity that we so critically need.
Well, now we're getting a little bit clearer. The next page over in the report itself, under the title Executive Summary, this 2024 ESOO demonstrates that the timely delivery of expected investments in generation, storage, and transmission is critical to maintaining reliability for electricity consumers. AMO forecasts show reliability levels can be maintained over most of the next 10 years if programs and initiatives already established are delivered on time and in full. This includes delivery of planned, actionable transmission projects, investments supported by federal and state government energy programs, and coordination of consumer energy resources.
Oh no! Oh no!
The Oh No Monkey is brought out again in what I believe is a fair response to the claims that without the expected investment from us, the consumers, in our home batteries, maybe EVs as well, who knows, and then not only to buy them and install them and use them, but not for our benefit, for the grid's benefit. This is one of the big problems. Expected.
This particular ESOO has a very, very clear message.
Yes, the clear message is, under executive summary still, and I quote, the main findings of this 2024 ESOO are, if delivered on time and in full, then federal and state government programs providing additional renewable generation and dispatchable resources, actionable transmission developments, and coordination of forecast consumer energy resources would provide sufficient generation capacity to meet growing electricity demand within relevant reliability standards over most of the next 10 years. Timely delivery of these expected investments is critical. If further investment beyond current committed and anticipated projects is delayed or does not materialize, AMO forecasts reliability gaps will exist over the coming years in some NEM regions.
Why do only 10% of customers dip their battery into a virtual power plant? You know, this is one that we are collectively going to have to really steer it and figure out, because is the incentive not enough for customers to be doing that? Are they buying a battery for a completely different reason? Is it not clear on how it works? Are people worried about the degradation of their own battery and they're putting it in for a different use? It's surprising. It's surprising to me, having worked in the space for 5 years, that number is as low as what it is. But it doesn't bode well.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
That last piece there was Dominic Vandenberg, head of the Poles and Wires Lobby, Energy Networks Australia, talking to the Renewal Comedy podcast about how consumer energy resources, home batteries, there's only 10% participation rates in these coordination schemes, the virtual power plants. So no, it doesn't bode well at all, does it? Combine that with the community outrage in the regions at being forced and expected to host these renewable energy zones, the wind and solar, and all that, when there's a perfectly good set of infrastructure ready to go. We're already using it. We have been for years. It just needs a few upgrades here and there, and it's good to go for another 50 years. Okay, the Bush Summit, featuring Barnaby Joyce and Matt Keane. Now here we're going to remove some of the bluster and the argy-bargy and all the rest of it, because I'm interested in the messages, not the personalities. We have Barnaby Joyce, who speaks with emotion and plenty of words and a little bit of bluster, but he's usually pretty correct once you get through the, through the personality. Matt Keane is very polished, very rehearsed, very well scripted, and his message is, well, his message is the message, the narrative. He's on board with the renewables rollout. He wants it. Let's have a look. Oh, the other one is the questioner. We had 9 questions for Barnaby Joyce with 2 fact checks in addition. And for Keane, we had 2 questions in total. In fact, the questions for Keane were, Barnaby said that renewables don't work in any other country. Can you talk about that? And the other question for Matt Keane was, are you personally opposed to nuclear power? The rest of the time, the attention, the focus of the questioner was on Barnaby Joyce and holding his feet to the flames. First of all, before we go through and have a look at the questions, let's have a look at some of that bluster and argy-bargy between the two.
Nuclear is 3 to 5 times more expensive than firm renewables. That's what the CSIRO says. Take it up with the CSIRO.
CSIRO is an Australian organisation.
That's right.
A trusted institution.
All the other institutions.
So all the other countries are wrong.
Developed Wi-Fi, developed Bluetooth, helps our farmers with soil crops.
Finland's wrong. China's wrong. Russia's wrong.
Our farmers trust the CSIRO.
Wrong.
That's good enough for me, and I trust them.
United Arab Emirates wrong. They're all wrong. We are the only smart ones. Chris Bowen, the CSIRO, are the intelligent ones, and we are the only ones to step.
Barnaby, can I ask you?
Just because you're talking doesn't help people lower their power bills in 20 years' time. We need to help people now, and it's renewables that will do that now.
Global facts.
I hope while you're listening, you can appreciate that. Sometimes it's better not to listen to the bluster and the argy-bargy. In this case, Matt Keane is relying on the CSIRO, the trusted institution, and he does that repeatedly throughout the course of the debate. And Barnaby is correct by saying that the power prices keep going up and that renewables are to blame. Unfortunately, Barnaby doesn't seem to know quite why that is. Anyway, let's get into it with the questions.
Barnaby, how divisive is this issue? Matt, Barnaby says that renewables can't power any country. What do you say to that? You talk about this as if you have no say in it. You were in government for 9 years.
Yep.
That prices were rising during that time as well. What do you say is the solution to rising power bills now? So the earliest we could see nuclear is after 2035. Power bills are going up now. They're going to keep on going up. What do you say is the solution today? Barnaby, so do you have any evidence that farmers actually do have to pay for the...
Yeah, absolutely.
Where has it happened? Barnaby, I have to pull you up on that. The Clean Energy Council says that the project owner will either decommission the site, restoring the area to its previous land use, or negotiate with land users...
Okay.
Landowners to repower or upgrade the equipment or extend the wind
farm. I'm happy to
site.
Take you on that.
My question is, has it happened? Has a farmer in Australia been left to deal with a wind turbine that at the end of the life of a farm? Are you personally opposed to nuclear? During the 9 years of the coalition government, did you try to get nuclear up in Australia?
All the time. And I could go through...
Why didn't it happen?
Because they say, the polling doesn't agree with
you. Who said that?
Were the Deputy Prime Minister.
Scott Morrison said that to you.
Absolutely, 100%.
He said that the polling didn't support...
That's correct.
Yeah, and so it didn't go ahead.
Well, that's...
Because the government you're a part of wasn't willing to take on that fight.
And
the opposition's proposal is not for the market to build nuclear, it's for the government to build nuclear, the taxpayer to build nuclear. Barnaby, when we started, you were telling us about how the renewables rollout is the most divisive issue in regional Australia.
Absolutely, 100%.
When the coalition announced its nuclear proposal, did it do enough consultation with the 7 communities before it made that announcement? Should more coal-fired power stations stay open for longer?
So there you have it. 9 questions and 2 fact checks on Barnaby Joyce and 2 questions for Matt Keane. Let's go straight into Barnaby's cut-down responses. Remember here, we're after the message, not the personality.
This piece of legislation from 2020 is probably the most divisive thing that's happened in my time in politics. It has split communities completely down the middle. It has made good friends become pathologically at each other's throats. I've seen people just abuse another person straight to their face in front of other people. And the reason it does that is for on the premise of this. Number one, intermittent, it's not renewable. Please don't call it renewable. It's intermittent power. It's intermittent power, and there is not a major economy in the world that works on it. In Germany, in the last half, their power prices were 41% higher than other parts of Europe. A third of their economy wants to leave. And what we're doing, what's happened, is this has been intruded on us, thrown on us. They're not putting it off Bondi Beach. They're not putting it transmission lines through Mossman. They just came out and said, we're going to have these reses. Aren't they wonderful? We're going to have these reses. And what happened to us is we just woke up one day with the diminution of the value of our land, the transmission line over our property, swindle factories, the so-called wind towers, this forlorn and becoming obsolete, to become future landfill around us. And what have we done to the poor person in the poor town? We've made it so she can't afford her power bill. We've humiliated her. We've made her poorer. We've dragged her down. And at a time where our nation should be becoming as powerful as possible, we're making our nation powerless. And if it was going to work, I'll give you an example. Go to Alice Springs, 25,000 people, no heavy industry, lots of sun, lots of wind. See if you can make it there, work there before you inflict it on our whole damn nation. Ladies and gentlemen, when you get that little thing in the mail with a box in it called the power bill, there lies the truth. Now, I'm going to pose one question to you. Forget about AEMO and we're here, there, quoting all this fantasia of what might happen in the future. Has that power bill been going up or down? I mean, last quarter, our inflation rate, if they hadn't put up, with the subsidies, your power went up by 6% annualised. Without it, it would have gone up by 12%. Name me the country in the world. One, the world's a big place, where intermittent power, this intermittent swindle, has worked. We used to have the cheapest power in the world, and now we've got some of the dearest power in the world. Now, if what he said was correct, remember I posed the question, name me one country in the globe where intermittent power has A, driven an industrialised economy, and B, made power prices cheap, and he couldn't give us one. The second thing is this. If what he says is correct, it's about the war in the Ukraine, it's about gas and the Nord Pipestream and all that, well, why is Finland's power cheaper than us? Why is France's power cheaper than us? Why are these other countries, except Germany, which has completely botched it, why is their power cheaper than us? They live in the middle of this catastrophe. You have to get baseload power onto the system. That's left right. Out a very crucial thing. He said that Finland's power system is different and France is different. But he left out a crucial point because it's got nuclear. But they actually have to keep that baseload going. We are going to be mugged by reality on this one. Because if we go down this path, ladies and gentlemen, the lights are going to go out and the poor become poorer. And that is who we're supposed to be looking after, number one. The dignity of that person in their house to be able to have electricity. We are losing that in this nation. Why didn't you say, well, then the government will be responsible for the decommissioning and rehabilitation of the land after the swindle factories, the wind towers, become obsolete? Why did you leave that on the farmer's chit? And it was actually Senator Rennick who asked him. He said, look, who's responsible for decommissioning these and pulling it down? You know, you'll have a company in Shanghai and it gets the DA through and then it flips the deal and then it flips the deal again and it goes 15 steps away and, of course, you're left with a $2 shelf company which is apparently going to decommission and rehabilitate the site. And the latest report, I think it was McCulloch Robson, came out and said between $400,000 to $600,000 a tower. As these are coming on, we're going to come up in the next few years of the decommissioning of these sites. The first sites, even around Glen, has 3 megawatt towers. They don't build 3 megawatt towers anymore. They're 8 megawatt towers. Mm-hmm. So what do you reckon is going to happen to 3 megawatt towers
when, as like everything, static technology becomes obsolete. Who's pulling these things down? Listen, if it was so dear, ladies and gentlemen, why don't we just remove the prohibitions so you can build them if you want to, and then the market would say, oh, it's ridiculous, CSIRO's got a report, says you can't do it. But they've still got the prohibitions in place. You know why? Because they actually know it works. The facts are the price is going through the roof. Is there one person in this room who thinks the price of electricity is going down? They've done polling on the area. It's actually in support of nuclear power. What you have is people who had black rocks that used to boil water, create steam and turn a turbine, and they're very power literate. And so now we've got a different rock that boils water, creates steam and turns a turbine. The electricians get their jobs back, the boilermakers get their jobs back, the fitters and turners make their jobs back. We can use a centralised spot there. We can use the existing transmission lines, not a whole swathe of new transmission trash all over the countryside. Which nation on earth has run their a modern economy? You can't run a full-time economy on part-time power. You're accelerating a disaster, not delaying a plan.
We're accelerating putting downward pressure on power bills, Barnaby. That's what we're trying to do.
They're not putting downward pressure on power bills. It's going through the roof. I mean, do you get a power bill? Have you ever looked at it?
Okay. To those of us hanging in there or still with us, that was 6 minutes of Barnaby Joyce whittled down to what I hope is the message and trying to get rid of some of the bluster and the argy-bargy out of the debate. If I was going to summarise Barnaby's positions, the points that he's made, I would say, one, that nuclear works in other places, that renewables don't work in other places, that power prices are going up. And he mentioned more baseload several times. So that says to me, That's a reasonable position to take. Now that we've heard the questions and Barnaby's points, what does Matt Keane have to say?
Well, I'd say that AEMO, the Australian Energy Market Operator, the engineers that we trust to rely our energy system, have a different view. I'd say that the CSIRO, the best scientist, an organisation, an institution with the best economists, scientists, a respected institution, say differently. So we should be making this debate about economics and engineering, not ideology. And that's what energy policy should be all about. Whether we get energy to our house when we need it and our bills are as low as possible. And the facts are these, that the reality is that today the cheapest way of delivering reliable energy is firmed renewables. That's, again, not me saying that. That's the CSIRO, one of our most trusted institutions, and AEMO, the engineers who run our energy system. So we either believe the experts or we don't. Okay. And I'm for the experts. What we do know is that power bills are going up for two very clear reasons. One, there's a war in the Ukraine. That has pushed the wholesale price. That has pushed the wholesale price of coal up. It's gone up almost 300%. The majority of our resources are going offshore to power other economies. The second point is that supply is coming out of the system because these power plants are old. It's got nothing to do with climate change. It's got everything to do with the fact that they're old kit. They were built in the 70s and they're end of life. We need to build more supply into the system. More supply will put downward pressure on prices. Finland's power system is different to Australia's power system.
Why?
France's power system is different to Australia's power system. We have a system that was built on coal. Those ageing coal-fired power stations are getting older, they're becoming less reliable, and they're coming out of the system. They need to be replaced. And the cheapest way to replace them, again, according to the experts, is firmed renewables. That's renewables with batteries, gas, those technologies. That's what will bring down power prices. That is, firmed renewables, according to the CSIRO, are cheaper than coal, and they're far cheaper than nuclear. I think we're trying to help people now. We need new generation built into the system right now to put downward pressure on bills. We can't wait. Barnaby's talking about something in 20 years. We can't wait 20 years. We've got to help people now. And the best way to help people now is to build more supply into the system. That's what's put downward pressure on prices. That's what will help with power bills immediately. I'm supportive of the facts. I'm not opposed to nuclear per se, but it needs to be helping with people's power bills, and it needs to be delivered. And let's get the facts on the table. Nuclear is 3 to 5 times more expensive than firm renewables. Even if you remove the prohibition, you can't deliver it for 20 years. That's not going to help people today.
Well, that might be great in 20 years, Barnaby, but we've got to deal with cost of living.
So we're going to wreck the place for the next 20 years.
No, we need to get new supply into the system to put downward pressure on bills. Helping more supply and lower bills means families are better off, businesses are better off, and our country is better off. Barnaby's got a plan for 20 years. Good luck. We need to help people now, and that's why we need to get on with the job and support our economy now. Even if you try and extend them, it doesn't make them more reliable. They are not going to survive for the 20 years that Barnaby's saying we can wait. More supply means lower
power bills.
We need more supply in the system. They're the facts.
And there we have 3.5 minutes of Matt Keane debating Barnaby Joyce all on his own. My summary of Matt Keane's position is he backs CSIRO and AEMO exclusively in this, and he believes we need more electricity now, more generation now. When Matt Keane says that we need more electricity supply in the system and that that will lower electricity prices, he's exactly right, except it won't work with intermittent electricity because it's not always there. Therefore, you introduce more volatility and that pushes the long-term price up for the retailers. Adam Bandt also says something that sounds sensible on the surface, but you know, once you scratch the surface, he doesn't actually mean something sensible.
And so if we had a mindset shift and decided to massively invest in energy generation, we could drive the cost of energy in this country down to close to zero.
Our interview this episode is Jonathan Fisher, CEO of Cauldron Energy. There are a couple of network dropouts towards the start, but bear with us because it settles down a few minutes in.
Jonathan Fisher, welcome to the Baseload podcast.
Thanks, Ben. Great to be here, mate.
Yeah, so I haven't talked to a mining CEO, especially because you're hoping to be a miner, aren't you? You're in the exploration and appraisal stage.
Yeah, that's right. We're actually out drilling. We've got a very large resource in Western Australia. We're out there drilling now to make it bigger because we can do that under the current regulatory regime in WA. What we can't do is mine it, though. So, my number one job is change of policy in WA and allow Western Australia to become a world-leading exporter of uranium.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would be hoping that that's going to happen. One of the questions I thought would be good from the perspective, your perspective, which is not yet mining but hoping to, there must be a litany of things that can go wrong as well as a few things that can go right, sort of domestically and abroad. In your role as the, you know, the CEO and a major decision maker and stakeholder in the company, what are some of those threats and opportunities that you see unfolding day to day?
Yeah, look, it's interesting because, you know, we see for global uranium demand, you know, what we're trying to do in the first instance is export or, you know, mine uranium, process it to yellowcake, and then export it to our strategic trading partners who are absolutely desperate for uranium from strategically aligned jurisdictions. So what drives that market is global nuclear growth. And all of that is just, you know, from the triple nuclear pledge at COP28 onwards, it's just gangbusters, absolute gangbusters. Against that drop of, problematic production from the likes of Kazakhstan, the world's largest, and the banning of sort of Eastern production of uranium into the US. So there's a very bullish market there. Now, you know, if you layer on top of that, then the opportunity for Australia to go nuclear and build reactors ourselves, that doesn't have a rule on the global. Yeah, it says 7 sites. There might be 14 reactors if it's two reactors a site. You know, it's not a huge difference, but what it would do, communities growing comfort with opportunities they're in. So, you know, it's both, obviously. But our number one driver is, you know, let's see. You know, nuclear is going gangbusters around the world because the United Nations says you do not hit net zero without nuclear. Mr. Bowen and Mr. Albanese think that Australia can. Good luck to them. But the rest of the world is clearly clued in that we don't. And so therefore, very strong future for uranium demand going forward.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I really hope we get to that point where we become an exporter of uranium from more than one source. You know, I think we've got Olympic Dam, but we closed down Ranger Mine in the Northern Territory last year or the year before. Something you said there triggered me into wondering about is political stability something that applies to uranium mining as much as it does to, say, coal or gas? Because I know that our overseas partners speak up occasionally about our potential political instability on gas and the changing regulations. Is uranium exposed to a similar sort of perceptions?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. There's a couple there. First of all, is a bifurcation in the market, east versus west, where, the West, the strategic West, and the world's largest market still for uranium being the US and the EU in a combined EU sense, wanting to separate itself, eastern sources of supply being Russia and China. So that is very neat. The Western markets have put in place something called the Sapporo 5 Initiative. They are putting in billions of dollars to try and encourage supply from Western aligned sources. That is essentially Australia, frankly. There's a lot of uranium possible in Africa, but Africa tends to be, risky. Russia, China leaning, actually. So, you don't necessarily say that Russia, Africa is the solution to Western needs. Mm. The second thing is obviously, we've had the Jabiluka decision in the last few weeks where it has just unilaterally canned the potential for future mining at Jabiluka, and there's 100 million pounds of uranium that won't be finding its way to the market. That's a concern. That is raising the prospect of sovereign risk in mining in Australia. Now, you go back 10 years, no one would have thought that sovereign risk was something that would come up as an issue for Australia. We have been the world's leading mining jurisdiction. We've been, we're a centre of excellence for mining. Who would have thought that sovereign risk in Australia is tipping up at the same time, for example, sovereign risk for uranium investment in Africa is going down? So, being a reliable source of supply is really important for our partners. We should be a reliable source of supply. We are getting the benefit of nuclear technology from trading partners, the US and the UK in AUKUS. And, it's not the strangest thing for them to say, hey, we are world-leading nuclear technology, so you get your national security objectives. How about you give us some uranium in reply?
We're trusted to receive that advanced technology, the nuclear subs, et cetera. Surely it goes hand in hand with being trusted to provide some fuel for them as well.
Absolutely. And, we do, let's be clear, we provide some fuel. We do mine, obviously, at Olympic Dam. There is also a US company called General Atomics that has a Beverley 4 Mile mine also in South Australia, and Boss Energy has just brought online the Honeymoon Project South Australia too. So we do have three producing mines, but, we have the largest potential markets in Queensland and in WA that still have bans. That doesn't make sense. So, we are a source supplier. We have a world-leading regulatory framework around our what is called Australian Obligated Nuclear Material. That is uranium that we export. We control it incredibly well. ASNO, which is the Australian Safeguards and Proliferation Office, is very well. If people want our uranium, we should just be able to give more of it to them.
Yeah, I agree. And I like the idea of being a go-to source for it that's miles away from Africa and Russian and Chinese influences. Mining in general has been facing some challenges. The gold mine in I think it's New South Wales has been in the news lately. apart from just the whole uranium nuclear challenges that, your industry is facing, are there, do you see these other sort of, whether it's cultural heritage or land access issues, are they something that you still have to deal with as well?
Oh, look, I've just written an opinion piece out this. I'm very concerned, as is our industry and our peak industry body, the Minerals Council. You know, if we go back a bit, and sorry to tell the story here, but, you know, Australia's first major generation of wealth was off the back of the sheep. Our second generation, massive generator of wealth, pegged to an iron ore cart or an excavator. So the mining industry has delivered more to this country than anything else in history. And we did that off what I call a balanced approach. So we are blessed with extraordinary resources in Australia. We're blessed with a labour force who is extremely capable, and we have expertise here like there is nowhere else in the world. And we had a regulatory regime built up over time, which provided extremely high levels of, but balanced that against development and the needs of the business. What has happened in more recent times is that that balance has just been thrown out the window, unfortunately. And, you know, a few things, you mentioned the Regis Resources decision by Fernie Plibersek. Now, that is, the reason people are so cut up about that, look, it's not that there was a denial of the project, but they were led along the garden path. They've been working on that. They had all their other approvals. The formal Indigenous group that we are meant to coordinate with as part of our you know, Native Title and Heritage process approved the project. Yet, you know, Tanya Plibersek managed to find one elder who the official heritage group don't actually know, and managed to base a decision on that. So that's you know, uncertainty and surprise is what creates sovereign risk. But quite apart from that, you know, we've had the proposed what's called nature positive changes to the environmental approvals at a Commonwealth level, and that's a really clever bit of marketing because, you know, nature positive. Oh, how can we say that's bad? Well, the fact is, putting in place a completely, you know, what you call independent EPA with control over time and approval, is very, very, very bad for project development. The latest changes that the federal government have put in with respect to potential reunionisation of the Pilbara workforce is a real concern. You know, and you've also had in WA, I think you mentioned them, new cultural heritage laws, which were so poorly received that the government had to actually to cancel them. So they were brought in for a period of a month, and then they were retracted. And again, that all just goes towards sovereign risk, to the extent that now we have tier one mining companies who are refusing to put a dollar more to work in Australia. And that's got to concern everybody because, you know, if the mining industry is not growing, you know, Australian standard of living will decline.
Yeah, and I think everyone accepts that mining does have an environmental impact, but that can be managed and repaired over time. But the net benefits of the mining, with the jobs and the you know, the taxes and the royalties, even though some might say they're really bloody high, there is a huge benefit to that for Australia overall. And it's crazy to try and to risk that for these short term political sort of gains, which are nowhere near mining communities anyway to start with.
Yeah, look, I think there is always an open question about whether or not the mining industry pays enough in royalties, taxes, and everything else. And, you know, both sides can make their views known on that. And can there be change? Sure. I think one thing needs to be, people need to understand that without mining, I mean, not only do Australians reduce their standard of living, but without mining, there is no energy transition. So mining is the number one thing that is required, and in fact is required to grow quite substantially if we want to decarbonise the economy, because you don't build a solar panel without mining. You don't build a wind farm without mining. You don't have the copper to electrify the economy without mining. And you certainly don't have your iPhone or your electric vehicle and your lithium batteries without mining. So, you know, it is this odd thing where it is the environmental lobby screaming out that we must decarbonize the world and that the carbon is the enemy and climate change is the here and now emergency of our generation, yet at the same time hamstringing our ability to deliver it.
And when they're quite happy for that mining to happen in the Congo or in China and all that, with all that devastation, and reap the rewards for the solar panels and the wind turbines and the iPhones, et cetera, here, where it's where the bad part is out of sight, out of mind. I relate it a little bit to the live export market. It bothers me that with Australia goes, oh, dust our hands of that, we're clean because we don't do it. And yet they're just pushing that industry into an area which is going to massively expand to the detriment of the animals. I mean, goodness me.
Yeah. Look, that's an interesting point you make, and it's something in a discussion or an argument, whatever you want to call it, that I had with an environmentalist not too long ago. Because I said exactly that, and, you know, with respect to uranium, for example, hey, should we be mining it in the world's best jurisdiction where we have the highest standards of compliance, or should we be doing it in Africa? And they got very angry and said, "Oh, you miners, you should have the same standards anywhere." And I was like, "Well, hang on. Actually, Australian companies do pride themselves at being, you know, jurisdiction agnostic. And, you know, BHP going into Africa or Australia would operate in a similar manner. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about if Australian companies don't do it in Australia, you might have Chinese or Russian companies doing it in Africa. And I guarantee you that Chinese or Russian companies do not have the same standards that we do as Australian companies. And so you do need to take that global view of going, should Australian world-leading industry have a chance and ensure the best environmental compliance, or do we risk, you know, letting others do it in lesser, environmental jurisdictions and frameworks?
Yeah, it's not often you'll find an environmentalist who thinks logically along those lines. Recently, Jono, you were at a Western Australian, I think it was in Western Australia, you did a big talk with a big PowerPoint slide, and you expanded your remit beyond dedicated to mining, and you took on a little bit of the domestic energy policy as well. And you're a little bit critical, I think, of the current direction that we're going. What was your reception in that environment to your kind words?
Yes. So, I mean, that was the West Australian Mining Club, biggest event of the year, actually. It's the biggest event I'd ever talked in front of. I was very nervous, but it was well received. Obviously, that is it was a pro-mining crowd, and I talked a lot about uranium. But I did also talk about, you know, the need for competitive energy pricing and the concerns around the current pathway that we're going down and whether or not it passes the pub test. At the highest level, we keep being told renewables are the cheapest form of energy, yet everyone in the room stuck their hands up when I asked the question, whose power bills have gone up? And I know, Ben, you and I have had discussions in the past around our views on gen cost, Yep. And the AEMO ISP, I could talk for hours on it. But I think, you know, the proof is in the pudding. And, you know, we are seeing power prices going one way. We are seeing, you know, there have been a couple of brownout events and the threat. So not only have there been actual brownouts, but, you know, the communications that from AEMO saying, oh, geez, the reserve margin's pretty poor, you know, we're at risk of one, weather dependent, you know, all of that talk is becoming more and more common. And, you know, as a first world jurisdiction where we should be facing a future of energy plentifulness and reliable, well-priced power for a country that is so blessed in the amount of energy that we have inherent within our borders, for us to be in this situation is, I think, I think in South Australia today, even the Premier, the Labor Premier said, you know, the power bill situation is a massive failure of public policy. I mean, it gets down to that.
And there's only one electricity policy at the moment, and this is follow the AEMO's recommendation, which is driven by political targets, and it's nothing to do with the consumer. It's nothing to do with the ultimate energy security of this country, which is ironic because you're taking great pains in your day job to try and export energy security to other countries, but we don't even get a taste of that ourselves. It really bothers me that.
And yeah, uranium, just on a moment, uranium is so energy dense, right, that we export an extraordinary amount of energy already, essentially with uranium. And if we gave that uranium credit for the carbon it displaces instead of burning coal, you know, we are essentially already displacing about 200 million tonnes a year of carbon through our existing uranium exports.
But let's ban it.
And our argument is if we let WA export, we let Queensland export, well, that 200 million tonnes a year turns into about 5 to 600 million tonnes a year, which means we don't just blow through net zero. We become massively through net zero on the back of those energy exports. Now, another way to look at it is, you know, we're still very happy to export energy in the form of coal to other places, yet we're not willing to burn it for our own energy security. And that is something that that is troubling in its ways, because guys, it's global warming, right? It is, you know, it doesn't matter where the emission is, it's global warming, although from our own frameworks, you know, yeah, we're talking about emissions reduction within Australia. There's a slight inconsistency in thinking on that.
And that's not just that inconsistency is not just in our own domestic politics. We have, the head of the UN, Antonio Guterres, every now and then he pops up admonishing Australia for using so much coal and gas. And yet is he there and telling us to stop our exports? But is he likewise going to the countries that we export this stuff to? Who are the ones who are buying it? If they weren't buying it, well, we'd just use it ourselves, right? But he could maybe have.
He does say, you know, he is also one of the ones that's saying we don't hit net zero without more nuclear. So, you know, let's get it. Let's global community more nuclear needed, which would obviously be good for our exports of uranium.
I wonder if if Antonio is going to join Will Shackle's Nuclear for Australia campaign anytime soon.
He's got some pretty good backers. I mean, it's remarkable what Will's been able to achieve. So, well done.
I'm looking forward to his future career. I think we'll all be paying keen attention. I wanted to, in the last few minutes, you're a CEO, which is great. You're in the C-suite. What are other CEOs talking about? What's going on out there in C-World?
So energy security and cost is a big thing for business, as it is obviously for residences and small businesses. I speak, for example, to a number of operators in the data center industry who are absolutely, you know, put it blunt, shit scared about where they get reliable isolated energy from, you know, and preferably zero carbon. They don't have so with a data center, which is data centers and AI are essentially going to be the largest growth industry globally over the next decade. And whether or not Australia has a role to play in that will depend on whether or not we have enough energy available at a reasonable price.
Data centers are not renowned for their ability to reduce their load during periods of cloudy weather, are they?
Yeah, so that's correct. It's interesting. So, you know, I was talking to some people last night in the Bitcoin mining industry, and so Bitcoin miners do flex load, and you know, if there's ever a little bit of spare power, they'll jump in and take it. But AI data centers, nope, they need it. They're on 24/7. Their demand is extremely stable, and it has to be. Mm-hmm. And you know, the message from both government and private sector data center operators here in Australia is that we are constrained for growth. We do not have enough energy available. And frankly, you know, and this is government people talking to me off the record, they don't think renewables are going to deliver what they need to run the government's data centers.
So where do they put their, who do they talk to when they're talking to the government? Do they say we need more subsidies, Mr. Bowen, or do they say please do something a bit more substantial, Mr. Bowen, and go for nuclear, or do they turn around and go, please go back to coal, just do something that's going to work for us?
Yeah, I don't know the level of input they have. I mean, my view on the current government policy is that it is driven by ideology without, frankly, much input at all from industry. You know, Mr. Bowen wants to hit his 82% renewables by 2030 and about 90-something percent by 2035. Mm. And that is, you know, that is, it is an ideological target.
Yep, that's made it
that's
up.
Been set.
Yep.
And, you know, the likes of GenCost and AMOISP are used in a way to communicate to the community that, oh, no, it's not ideology, it's economics. It's cheapest. And they
don't
do
dare
that.
Argue. Yeah.
they do that because, you know, the community is willing to accept an argument that, oh, well, if economics is cheapest, then fine, we'll go with it. The community in Australia, you know, is not particularly liking of ideological stuff, just like as a community, and this is where we're quite different to the US. Generally, religion and religious-based stuff doesn't tend to go well with the majority of the community in Australia. We're quite secular. But similarly, we don't like ideological stuff either, except obviously for the very left and loud components of the Greens and the left Labor. And so what they do to win an election, you need to capture the middle. Okay, well, the middle is a rational actor, and therefore we're going to dress it up as economics and say it's cheaper. And how do we do that? Well, we come up with all these interesting structures, like saying that we're going to take the benefit of community storage services, make the population pay for their own storage, let the network use it, and therefore, if we don't have to include those hundreds of billions of dollars in the network expenditure, hey, you know what? Renewables might seem cheaper.
I love it that you've gone into the detail to that level, because that's one of the big missing items from the ledger, which is the integrated system plan's cost. Mr. Bowen pulls out his $122 billion. And he said it a few different times now. He was saying $121 billion a couple of years ago, but it got revised up slightly. But as we know, that's actually a net present value of a whole lot of spending out to 2050, which when you add it all up is around about the $400 billion mark. And
it excludes stuff.
Yeah, and that's missing out. Or like you mentioned, the home batteries that us consumers are meant to buy and install and then be operated to the benefit of the network, maybe not to our benefit, which I find quite interesting. And it's like you said, the Australian community typically doesn't buy ideology. They like just the pub test should work, and none of this passes the pub test when you get into the details. Now that's a problem, because it's all hidden behind these layers of reports. And I've got a sneaking suspicion that some journalists are waking up to it, because I don't think the average punter or my baseload podcast or your mining conference, I don't think that information is not going to hit the majority of people. It has to come from the journalists, say, whether it's a John Kehoe or if it's a, who are the Australian ones, Perry Williams, et cetera, or someone in the ABC, maybe Patricia Karvelas. Now, I have a sneaking suspicion that some of these journos are actually picking up on there's a rat. They smell a rat, but they don't quite understand how to get at it and understand it. Do you see any awakening happening, whether it's in the journalist or the community?
Well, obviously, you know, and we all see what arguments back and forth that we have publicly, whether it be on Twitter or others, and you know, privately, I also, you know, I'm very willing even privately to discuss and debate with others of the alternate view, and there are some particular people of very high profile who we may know who we're talking about. They have the habit of tweeting things that are anti-nuclear, for example. And, you know, that question on batteries is very interesting because there is an argument that says, okay, well, if people are going to buy batteries, this is the crux of it, if people are going to go buy batteries at the same rate under either plan, then fine. They both cancel each other side of the ledger, you don't have to include. And so one of those people suggests that that's the case, that Australia will get to 90x% penetration of every household having a battery. And I'm like, I'm sorry, that is not. I mean, obviously, there's a proportion of technology leaders and early adopters that would do that. Fine, you might get to 30%. But absolutely 90 not. And I said, the thing is, we can learn from what's going on overseas. And it's fantastic that we have countries right next to each other in Germany and France that have gone down completely different routes. So France is where I think we should be maintaining strong baseload power through, you know, a mix of nuclear over time plus gas and some coal. You know what? In the data to 20, the latest data I had was 2022, there were 1,000 home batteries in France, the whole country, right? 1,000.
Yep.
Germany, same time frame, gone down, obviously, their energy bond, mass renewables, closure of baseload. Germany in 2022 installed 250,000 batteries in 1 year. Now, what that shows is that a difference in generation strategy versus, you know, baseload versus mass renewables will have an impact on consumer behavior of whether or not they buy batteries. And so because that, I mean, that's proven internationally. And the good thing about Germany and France, they're on a sort of the same level in terms of weather there. So it's not as if you can say, well, one's massively better for renewables and one's not. And what that demonstrates is that consumers will change their behaviour and not incur that cost if they feel they don't need to. Mm. Obviously, the Germans feel they need to. French go, I'm pretty comfortable as I am relying on my extraordinarily reliable, low-carbon nuclear power.
I think that is
a comparison that journalists should quite happily say, well, if this is the case in Europe, why the hell do we expect it to be different here?
And of course, one of the drivers that would push people who could afford the capital cost of the batteries, or maybe even with subsidies, would be very high electricity costs and the opportunity to use that battery for their own benefit to sort of insulate themselves from that price volatility, especially with your surge pricing on the smart meters. But where the ISP falls down in that sense with the community energy resources is the word coordinated, which actually means it's not for your benefit, it's actually for the grid's benefit. And that might even imply that there's kilowatt hours of capacity in each of those batteries reserved for somebody else's use at certain times of the day. So that discussion is probably going to put a dampener on the whole home battery thing, kind of like the EV thing. Like there's a market limit beyond which the natural uptake is just not going to go. Certain people aren't going to do it.
I mean, I think with EVs, there's a little bit of a driver because, you know, the government and the car makers have an ability just to shut out internal combustion engines from the market, right? So, you know, if we want a car, we might be forced to buy an EV, and therefore you'd be more likely to have high penetration of EVs on the streets. But, you know, you look at the ISP, and I think it was from memory, at a CER, they were talking about 157 gigawatt hours of storage in the land by 2050. Mm. And you're like, well, look, even if that works, even if community coordinated energy resources work, you know, what proportion of people will sign up? Mm. You know, and any modelling of, you know, amount of storage to dispatchable energy that you need, so, you know, some of the numbers I've seen saying, no, well, to make it all the work, you might need 400 or 500 gigawatt hours of notional storage capacity to get the level of certainty that you're after. In a scenario where energy intensity and energy use is probably looking to be, on the upside.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. I've spoken to people about Peter Dutton's nuclear plan, which is admittedly is pretty loose, but I think I wrote a piece in The Spectator a few weeks ago basically saying this is probably as good as it gets at this point. We've gone so far down the wrong path with the rooftop solar eroding market share, and it's slowing down, but it's not, it's still going to exist, right? Which is that problem just exists now. It's a giant black hole in the market. And there's a whole bunch of the intermittent stuff that's already in the system, and you can't just go around and bulldoze it. And the coal is getting old and something has to be done. So I think another government intervention is probably the right way to go about it. Now, some might call you slightly biased because of the nuclear angle, but where do you think that sits in terms of a policy? Is it a net good for Australian consumers, or is there some negatives attached?
So, you know, there's some people that say the government, you know, should not build anything, and a free market should decide. And the argument against that is, you know, one of the things around nuclear are, construction guarantees and other things like that, where what you've seen internationally is actually often the government will build and then flog it off to the private sector. As it does with other, health infrastructure and other things. So, whereas Mr. Dutton's plan is to say it's a national bit of infrastructure, I would not be at all surprised if once built and operating and then the government was in need of something to fix a budget black hole, they decided to sell off the nation's nuclear fleet. And in fact, I was involved in London. I sold the British nuclear fleet to the French in the largest all cash deal in UK corporate history, actually. So, that does, there's precedent, I guess, for that. Mm. I think the initial plan of, when the policy was first leaked or first mooted, this whole focus on SMRs, I think, was wrong. Mm-hmm. Because, you're immediately set up to say, well, SMRs, are they commercially available at scale within a short time frame?
Yeah.
I keep trying to use the words instead of SMR, which means small modular reactor. I keep telling people to use words LMR, large modular reactor, which is essentially what we have with the AP1000 and the APR1400, which are large units which are simply built as much as possible in a factory to get efficiency, improve constructability, reduce cost and reduce time, while still having the benefits of economies of scale. So, my view, let's build LMRs. We've got them here today. SMRs over time, as they become proven and available, and indeed micro reactors will play a really interesting role a little bit further down the track, as again things like the Da Vinci reactor from Westinghouse become more common.
Yeah, interesting. The whole government building something and then selling it off is a tried and true path, I guess. Government ownership of critical infrastructure. Where do you stand on how that sits? There's obviously 100% government owned and there's 100% private owned. I think there's a role for government ownership. What's your take on it?
Yeah, look, I've been involved in the utilities and infrastructure investment banking back in my earlier career. That was in the UK. We have very similar arrangements to the UK in terms of regulated asset base and other arrangements. I think there is a very successful model of, certain assets being regulated, but in the private sector, and that can work. That said, what that allows you to do as a government is to take the capital that you get there and then recycle that, right? So you know, our cities are constantly expanding. The government needs to build new hospitals, schools, et cetera. And redeploy that capital into growth areas. So I think there's, that's a model that works. Specifically with nuclear, look, I think it is a common thing for, governments to play a role in back-ending some of the construction risks and other things like that. Once they're operating and spitting out shitloads of money, flog them off and go again.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that in principle. And I think the power sector is, with its large upfront capital costs, I think governments can de-risk that stuff, get it operating, get it debugged. A few years down the track, you know, someone might come and make a good offer for it. But I think the counter argument, which a lot of people would raise, and I think there is some risk there, is that selling off a high-priced asset with almost not quite a captured market, but electricity is getting close to it, like water and roads. How do we put a cap on or make sure that the system remains affordable even with privatization going on? So I think that seems like an obvious question, especially in this day and age when new investment haven't even gone back to building baseload because of the risks involved.
Yeah, and look, obviously that is a structure that gets worked through, but it's exactly what the regulated asset-based model does, right? So it says, you know, we will, put a dollar value on that, and you make a regulated return on your regulated asset base. Now, if the private sector is able to make efficiency gains on that regulated asset base, well, they can make super normal profits, right? And that's where the benefit of the private sector comes. But what it should do is cap the return, the regulated return, and therefore the price that consumers get paid. Now, is it a perfect system? It's not. But, you know, it is a tried and true method of funding public infrastructure in Australia and overseas. So, you know, it's one of the models that can be used.
Okay, I suppose it's worked on and off here in Australia, and I'm thinking of the transmission system, where obviously there's regulated caps on that, and that's a revenue cap, so they've got to justify their OPEX and their CAPEX returns and all their depreciation, and then a bit of margin on top of that. But then, luckily for the transmission companies with their regulated returns based on their regulated asset base, the government says, please expand your asset base massively.
and that's where you would catch us some cream. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, Johnny, you've been a great guest. I do have a quick question, which I was wondering about. CEO, so is it just the lucky hosts of podcasts that get to refer to you as Jono in emails and in person, or do you sign off your emails to your staff in that way as well?
No, mate. So, yeah, full name Jonathan, but it's only my wife calls me Jonathan or my mother, frankly, when I've done something wrong. So, you know, no, let's be friendly. I'm Jono, and my old man's name is John, so I can't shorten Jonathan to John. So Jono is what's left. Works well.
All right, nice one. I can accept that because my proper name's Benjamin, and yeah, my mum calls me that, and my wife dares to call it to me sometimes. I know I've done something wrong then.
Yes, and so look, you know, I love to chat to people in the market. I'm constantly learning, as is everyone. I encourage people to follow me on LinkedIn or Twitter. Reach out. DM me. I'm very responsive, and yeah, look forward to building on this conversation, and hopefully. We see some change, frankly, in energy policy going forward.
Excellent. Well, thanks, Jono. I'm not going to attest to your openness and friendliness. You've been good. Thanks very much.
Cheers, mate.
You've been listening to the Baseload podcast. If you like the show, subscribe and tell your friends. Remember, the mailbox is open, thebaseloadpodcast@gmail.com.